My guest today is Arianna Huffington, a familiar voice from left, right, and center. And she's with me here today to talk about her new book on becoming fearless in love, work, and life. Interviewing Bill Maher a couple of years ago, I asked him if he had any heroes. And he brought up the name of today's guest, not just because they're friends, which they are, but because, as he pointed out, she's been willing to change. In America, to change your mind in regard to politics is to flip-flop, and that's a sign of weakness. But Arianna went about her amazing transformation in full public view. Many would say she wouldn't have it any other way. Now, that took courage, and now she's written a book about that virtue. Arianna Huffington is a syndicated columnist, the founder of the online phenomenon, the Huffington Post, and the author of 11 books.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here with you.
As I said, you've written 11 books. People know there were the early biographies of Picasso and Callas. There were the earlier books, even, of the female woman and so on. But most of the books lately have been externally oriented. They've been about politics, about our society, about the trouble it's in. What led you to write this book on becoming fearless?
Two things that converged. One was that my daughters became teenagers. They're now 15 and 17. And I saw a lot of the fears that I had struggled with emerge in their lives. So my bald, fearless little girls suddenly started being consumed by questions like, am I pretty enough? Am I smart enough? Will people like me? What am I going to do when I grow up? And I wanted to help provide a kind of a roadmap, some shortcuts to fearlessness, by which, incidentally, I don't mean the absence of fear. I mean the mastery of fear, because fear is part of our DNA. It's part of our lives. What I'm talking about when I talk about fearlessness is doing what we want to do, saying what we want to say, even while we are afraid. And in the process, it's like a muscle, that the more we exercise it, the stronger it gets.
So you don't promise that people can read this book, do what it says, and become fearless, never to face fear.
Exactly. Now, what I do promise that they can actually see how to use that muscle. And the more they use that muscle, I absolutely promise that the easier it gets, because that's happened in my life, and it's happened in the lives of many of the other women in the book. So one factor was my daughters, and the other factor that prompted me to write that book was what was happening in the country. The fact that I kept writing how fear was driving so many of our policies, both on the part of the administration that used fear-mongering to get people basically to lose their sense of perspective about what was happening in Iraq or in this country. And also fear was what made so many democratic leaders not stand up to what they knew was right, and not stand up because they were afraid that they were going to be caricatured in the next election as being not patriotic enough or cutting and running or all those stereotypical expressions.
Well, to some extent, they would have been criticized for being afraid when, in fact,
they would have been
it
brave.
Was the fear
exactly,
of that.
Exactly. So it was this kind of convergence that made me realize that candidates, including candidates on our side of the aisle, can say all the right things. But the question is, how do they act when times get tough, when a lot is at stake? And very often, if they don't have a personal foundation of fearlessness, they're going to act out of fear. So I became really interested in that, which I've always been interested in our own personal journey. I mean, mine happens to be a very spiritual journey, but I have friends who are fearless, who are atheists, so it doesn't have to be. But that journey of getting to know ourselves, becoming more conscious of our own flaws, of our own character, has always been a huge preoccupation of mine. So here it's emerging in this book in a new way, which is, for me, bringing together everything I've learned from my life. This is definitely the most personal book I have ever written, but also the stories of other women, some of whom are close friends, some of whom I admire, all of whom I know in some form or another. They have been part of my life in some form or another. So it becomes like a collective work.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, when I asked you, you said, okay, very close to home, my kids, on a very big external scale, the national culture, the national predicament. And then you said, you know, Democratic candidates and so on. Yet the book is addressed toward women.
Yes.
Why?
It's addressed towards women partly because my daughters are girls, I'm a woman, and partly because there are three areas in which we women are more prone to fear than you guys. Now, of course, I've had a lot of men who've read the book, and it speaks to them.
Well, that, yes, my follow-up question would be, but don't men need it just as much?
Absolutely.
Even if it looks different.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but I felt that targeting it to women had its own value because there were all these sort of women's voices there, all women's voices, and there's something very empowering about having those voices speak to us about fearlessness and their own journey from fear to fearlessness. So the reason why there are these three areas that we women are more prone to fear is partly just historical and partly cultural. One area is our bodies. You know, we are much more afraid of our body image, of what we look like. 10 million women went under the knife last year for plastic surgery, and we live in Los Angeles, and we see what that means. And also, as I write in the book, my youngest daughter went through the early stages of anorexia, and she actually wanted me to write about it in the book because she wanted to help other young women. But to see, you know, the cultural stereotypes that women internalize about thinness, about what beauty is, made me want to sort of provide an alternative, which is also much more of a European way of looking at our bodies. Where, you know, in French, there is even a sentence, you know, jolie laide, which literally means kind of
an odd beauty. Yes,
an odd beauty. But it really means accepting your uniqueness rather than wanting to look like an identikit, glamorized version of beauty, which sometimes you feel you have to use plastic surgery to attain.
I will tell you, I had my sister's children visit out here, she and her kids, and that was something they noticed, the expensive cars. They're from Atlanta. They noticed the expensive cars, and they noticed the plastic surgery.
Yes.
They would say, look at that woman over there. Look at the woman at that table. It was amazing.
Yeah, because if you come from the middle of the country, you notice it much more. The other two areas that women are more prone to fear are speaking out. There, again, all these cultural stereotypes about women who are assertive, who speak out, being shrill, bossy, bitchy. You know, Marlo Thomas said it best when she said, if you're a man, to be called ruthless, you have to be Joe McCarthy. If you're a woman, you just have to put somebody on hold. And the final area is the area of the inner critic. You know, we all have the inner critic, you know, the doubter, the voices.
It doesn't strike me. The other two a little more, but that one doesn't strike me as being gendered.
Except that in my experience, women have that inner critic in a more intensified way. It's like the obnoxious roommate, I call it in the book, who lives in our head and whose job is from the minute we get up to the minute we go to bed to put us down. I hope one day that Sony or Microsoft will invent a kind of some software that we can attach to our brain to get a transcript of what we say to ourselves, because not even our worst enemies talk about us the way
True.
We talk to ourselves about ourselves. So in the book, I talk a lot about silencing that voice.
Okay, let's try to, now I see why you did it toward women, but I'm not because, not just because I'm a guy, but I'm interested in what you learned as you focused on this during the writing of the book that doesn't show up in the book. So let's take it to the larger culture. Clearly fear is at the core of our society's troubles right now, and we have an administration about which you could say the only thing they have to use is fear itself. I know from an earlier interview I did with you that one of your earliest publishers said the reason you should write the Collis book, which you said I don't do biographies at the time, was he said you've got to learn to tell a story,
mm-hmm.
tell the narrative. What is the story? What is the narrative of America's giving in to fear over these last few years?
Well, the narrative is really that by giving in to fear, we've made terrible choices. We've made the worst foreign policy choice I believe this country has ever made by invading Iraq and staying there. And that was the product of fear. It was fear-mongering on behalf of the administration that made people literally not be able to see the truth.
But I can see that. I'm more curious about why the susceptibility. Why have apparently intelligent people given in?
I think the susceptibility has to do with having neglected our personal foundation of fearlessness. And that's really what interests me now. That's why I've been traveling around the country, and I have that sense of being in a campaign to spread fearlessness, not just promote a book, because I do believe that fearlessness is contagious the same way that fear is contagious. And if we can get a critical mass of fearlessness, we will be able to really build the kind of antibodies that will resist the fear-mongering. It's almost seeing it in medical terms. And that's why, you know, we are getting actually books out to elected officials running or candidates running, not just for national office, but all across the country. But beyond politics, way beyond politics, if we can just get to that tipping point of fearlessness, it will affect the culture, because it does. That's the kind of magical way that change happens.
But I can't imagine that people were less fearful, you know, are that much less fearful previously. And yet there's something going on where this administration, by design, it seems to me, will continually fan the flames of fear. And yet you see, it seems, I mean, at the 2004 election, I assume that whatever else we thought, we didn't expect it would still have as much power as it did.
Yes,
and yet it did.
And
now we've got another election coming up. Will it happen again? What is going on that this country, so powerful,
well,
so rich?
I write in the book about the appeal to our lizard brain. You know, fear makes us respond from our lizard brain instead of responding from our rational brain. And from that place, we basically miss a lot of what is happening, and we want somebody to reassure us. We become like childlike, and that's what needs to be addressed in a way that goes beyond offering the best policies or pointing out all the ways in which the course we are on is wrong, because it is about our own personal foundation of fearlessness. That's why I keep returning to that. So the more fearless we are in our relationships, at work, in parenting, the more fearless we will be as citizens, and the more able we will be to resist the fear mongering.
Because, as you say, it's a muscle that needs to be exercised. So this building of this muscle that we become more courageous, which is really what we mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
I actually looked up courage in the dictionary, and a simple dictionary had what I think is a wonderful definition. The capacity to face and deal with those things recognized as difficult, dangerous, or painful rather than withdraw from them.
Oh, that's fabulous. I love that. It reminds me of the quote I use in the book from Socrates, that courage is the knowledge of what is not to be feared. And that's incredibly important. It's really about perspective. And I have a chapter in the book about fearlessness in the face of God and death. And interestingly enough, the ancient Romans would carve the initials MM, memento mori, remember death, on statues and trees, not out of sign of morbidity, but because they wanted people to put everything else in perspective. You know, whether you believe in God or not, whether you believe in an afterlife or not, at least everybody can accept and admit that we're all going to die. So in the face of that, a lot of the things that make us afraid in the course of our life are pretty meaningless faced in the context of death. And so in the book, you know, I go from that
right,
a more kind of spiritual, if you want, source of fearlessness to the most practical tools that we can use to become fearless, which include sleep. I have found that it is much harder to be fearless if you are sleep deprived. And we're living in a sleep deprived nation.
You have a wonderful quote from Bill Clinton.
Yes. He said that my worst mistakes were when I was tired. And, you know, you can recognize that from your own life. I mean, I recognize it from mine. When I'm tired, when I haven't slept enough, I'm more moody, I'm more reactive. It's much easier.
Impulsive, I would
bet. Yeah, and it's much easier to respond not from the healthiest, most centered part of ourselves.
What has been the response to this book? And by that, I mean, if we say that people don't like people to change, and you took flack when you changed from what they perceived as a Gingrich person to your current persona, this, to some extent, I think would be perceived as a change as well. You're supposed to write about politics.
Yes, some people have pointed that out, but I have found going around the country just a wonderful response at a very personal level, which is why this tour has been very different from any other tour. It's like talking to friends. Because I've been personal and raw and vulnerable in the book, people are willing to do that with me. So I hear amazing stories from women all across the country who just share about this dysfunctional relationship. The woman who was doing my makeup at an Atlanta studio at 6:30 in the morning and then was doing it the next morning and had read the book in between was telling me about the relationship she was in and how it helped her recognize that she didn't have to stay in because she was afraid of being alone. And suddenly I had this incredible communication with her. And there we were, two women who never met each other, and we were talking at a really deep level. And that happened so much, and it is so incredibly empowering and just moving.
Whereas normally, if you were on tour, people would assume all you were interested in was politics, right?
Yes, exactly. So you talk at a different level, and also people would not open to you until you open to them. And so that's what happens here.
Speaking of that, you have a chapter about being fearless in love. And in it, you share almost nothing about your own experience since your divorce. You turn to other women who have my divorce caused this, my second marriage happened this way, my new romance happened that way. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, I chose to speak about my experiences in love. My first big love, Bernard Levin, while I was in my 20s. My experience with my divorce in terms of how it affected my children and how afraid I was of the impact it would have on my children. My relationship with my ex-husband and how I tried to make that work because friendship with your ex is so important when you have children and finally you've succeeded in having that. I haven't written about dating other men since my divorce, although you've met a couple, parents. Because I'm first and foremost a mother, and so writing about that didn't feel right in the context of being a mother. I mean, our children are very sensitive to that romantic, sexual part of ourselves. I mean, I know when I did Stephen Colbert last week, and this was the one show my oldest daughter stayed up until 11:30 to watch because she loves Colbert and never watches anything else I do.
And it wasn't because she loved you, right?
It's not about me at all.
Yeah.
And then she called me the next morning. She said, "Mommy, a little too much sexual stuff in the interview."
How old is she?
17. And, you know, there was all this sort of sexual joking in the interview. But it's just, you're a mom. For your daughters, you're first and foremost a mom. So it was out of respect for that.
I understand that. Something is in print all of a sudden.
Yes,
it's there
exactly.
5 years from now. It's whether he is or not, it's there.
Exactly.
Okay.
But I did say a lot about Bernard Levin and me because the fact that I was incredibly in love with him, I was with him for 7 years, and then he didn't want to marry me, he didn't want to have children, and I left, was for me just one of those incredible moments in my life when I acted in the direction that I wanted to go, even though I was not just afraid, but terrified. And it changed me, and it changed my life. And I want to repeat that because that's my promise, that when we do that, no matter how incredibly hard and painful it is at the time, it just changes in such profound ways that it's worth everything.
And as you point out in the book, and the book does include these stories, you not only left him, but because your turf so overlapped, you left England.
Right.
That's when you moved to the United States.
Because I was a chicken.
You were a courageous chicken?
Yeah, I was a courageous chicken. I didn't think I could actually stay away if I stayed in London. So I left London and moved to New York. And yeah. So actually I'm here speaking with you right now about my 11th book because a man wouldn't marry me.
Exactly. When was the last time you confronted fear?
Oh, I confront fear regularly. I confront fear around my children a lot. I watch myself moving into fear very easily when my daughter is 10 minutes late, beyond her curfew. Or most recently when I dropped Isabella off at the Santa Monica Pier and I was waiting for her to call about being picked up and she hadn't called and I couldn't get her on her cell phone, couldn't get a friend on her cell phone, couldn't get a friend's mother on her cell phone. And immediately I could see my mind moving into fear. And I quote Montaigne in the book saying, there were many terrible things in my life, but most of them never happened. So that's how it is with me and my children and fear. And that's when I put into practice the things I write about in the book. Watching the fear is the first step. You know, observation is a great first step towards distancing ourselves from the fear instead of being consumed by it. Breathing, you know, some very, very practical things, a sense of humor. All those things help me when I'm confronted with fear.
Let's move to an area that you mentioned earlier. What role does your spiritual life, or for anyone, spiritual life or religion, play in fearlessness and in your own fearlessness? And wouldn't it, I think some would say, religion and perhaps even spiritual life is a response to fear?
Well, I don't see it that way because I feel that every major religion has this at its core, the recognition that there is something more to our lives beyond this material existence, beyond our jobs, beyond our families. And that sense of perspective, that recognition that there is something else, that's some transcendence.
Allow me, if you will, to be the devil's advocate in this religious conversation and say that if, and you do talk about this, but if there is not, isn't the belief that there is a response to the fear that there isn't?
Well, you know, as a believer, in fact, as Carl Jung said when he was asked that question on the psychologist on television once, do you believe in God? He said, I don't believe, I know. So for me, it's not a matter of belief. You know, I really have that deep sense, which is beyond logic. But, you know, I have great friends who are atheists. I mean, one of them is somebody we know in common, Robert Greenwald, and he and I joke because he is a truly fearless man who takes on anything, and we joke about it. So I'm not saying for a second that you need to be spiritual to be fearless. No, I'm just saying that for me, it's an incredibly important element of my fearlessness foundation. But
Let me just tell people, Robert Greenwald is someone who, like yourself, has made a big change. He was a Movie of the Week producer, quite successful, some features, and now he directs and produces documentaries about tough social issues. His current one is Iraq for Sale.
Right, exactly.
And you're saying he comes to this work to heal the world from a place of atheism.
Yeah, and so I'm saying that because there are many, many ways from which we start to build that foundation of fearlessness. And we need to sort of honor the way that each individual chooses because that's really the key. I mean, in a way, fearlessness is about honoring who we are and being true to ourselves. And starting with our age, you know, I'm 56 years old. I think it's very important for women to say how old they are because the minute they begin to hide how old they are, there's a sort of sense that somehow There's something wrong with how old we are.
I will tell listeners that when I interviewed you in 2003...
I was not 56.
No, but I re-listened to that interview today, and you said, I'm 52 years old, and it struck me then. I said, not everyone does that. And here, it looks like you do it in every interview.
Well, I do it actually now. I do it around this book, because I have an entire chapter called Fearlessness in Aging. And I think it's so important to embrace our aging. I mean, I believe in maintenance, don't get me wrong. You know, I believe in taking care of myself, in working out, in eating well, in all these things. But there is no way to avoid aging. And if we embrace it, we also embrace its wisdom.
So this will probably be the last question. You've mentioned aging. You've mentioned being a mother. What role does your mother play in this, in you and in this book?
Well, my mother, to whom the book is dedicated, as well as my daughters, is very much the spirit that moves through the book, because she was a fearless woman. You've met her, and you know how fearless she was in every way. I write in the book about her standing up to the Nazis during the Second World War when they were hiding two Jewish girls in the mountains of Greece and were surrounded by German soldiers, and she walked up to them and said, we have no Jews here, put your guns down. And they did, because she spoke with such authority and fearlessness, which was my mother. From that to standing up to my father, who was an incredible philanderer, and told her not to interfere in his private life. And my mother left with two little girls and no money. And we lived in a one-room apartment, and she knew that we would get through it, but she had to be true to herself. And so she was an amazing role model, and I was very blessed that she lived with me and that she was this incredible grandmother to my two daughters right until she died in 2000. And she always gave me that sense of unconditional living and that sense of humor about everything. She used to say, angels fly because they take themselves lightly.
It's interesting that you just got to that, but we hadn't mentioned humor at all. I think it's something which
is... It's a huge part of fearlessness, yes, because, humor is just a way to put things in perspective, because you can laugh at things. And in the same way, not staying with things that you are no longer passionate or even interested in. I have a saying in the book that I call, you can complete a project by dropping it. And when I was 40, I made a list of things that I wanted to drop because I wasn't good at it, I wasn't interested enough in it. And we can all do that and leave more room for what is new and interesting to us.
Okay. And I want to mention, by the way, that there is a fearlessness section.
Yes,
at
in the Huffington Post. Called, you can go to it directly, fearlessvoices.com, or through the Huffington Post by clicking on Becoming Fearless.
Okay, Arianna, thank you for flying in from Las Vegas just to do this interview. Arianna Huffington's new book is On Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life, and the Huffington Post is where you find her and her collection of wonderfully opinionated bloggers. You can hear her also on KCRW's Left, Right, and Center almost every week, except for during these book tours.